I'm Frank Shiro.
Ooh, and here
I'm
it is. Everybody,
executive
stay
director
tuned.
For the Kodiak Chamber
State
of Commerce.
House District 32 Candidate Forum.
I want to welcome
forum.
You all to tonight's forum, and thank you for taking the time to attend this very important event. I also want to thank all of the candidates for taking the time out of their busy schedules to participate tonight, and I look forward to their responses to the important issue questions. Finally, I want to express my gratitude to Pam Foreman and the news staffs from KVOK and the Kodiak Daily Mirror for their assistance in putting tonight's questions together, and to KVOK and the Kodiak Daily Mirror for helping to sponsor tonight's event. Finally, thank you to Bill Oliver for moderating the forum tonight. And with that, I'd like to now turn everything over to Bill to begin the forum.
Thanks, Frank. And once again, folks, good evening and welcome again to the District 32 Candidates Forum. I am Bill Oliver, and I am your moderator this evening. The purpose of the forum is to let you have a chance to hear the candidates express their views on the important issues facing our community. The object, of course, is to make us all more informed voters. The format is as follows. We'll have a brief opening statement from each candidate, limited to 2 minutes, and then go right to the questions and answers. Each candidate will answer each question, and we'll rotate the order in which you answer the questions. So the person who answers the first question first will be the last to answer the next question. Then we'll finish up with a brief closing statement from each candidate. We have this light system here to help you stay within the 2 minute time limit. There'll be a green light when your time begins. After 90 seconds, a yellow light will come on, warning you that you have 30 seconds left. And when your 2 minutes are up, the red light will come on and your time is up. Please don't feel that you must use the full time allowed. If you're satisfied with the shorter answer, your audience most certainly will be too. So without further ado, the candidates present tonight running for the State House of Representatives are Democrat Dennis Harris and Republicans Louise Stutes and Rich Walker. We'll begin with the opening statements, starting alphabetically, either by first name or last, with Dennis Harris. Dennis?
Hello, my name is Dennis Harris. I am a new grad pharmacist from Kodiak, and I'm really excited to give back to my community, and I saw this as the best way to really make a difference. And I've been here since middle school. I just feel that there's a lot that can be done, and that if we work with the community, we can see some real change that will help people have a better life.
Thank you, Dennis. Next, Louise Stutes. Louise?
Thank you. I'm Louise Stutes, and it's been an honor to serve as your representative to the State House for the last 4 years. Our coastal communities rely on fisheries, a dependable marine highway system, tourism, and maintaining essential services that allow rural Alaskans to have a good place to live, work, and raise their children. As pressure continues to cut our state budget, it's vital our representation be in a position to protect those economic drivers. I'm again running as I've been effective in protecting those interests, and I believe I'm in the best position to continue doing so going forward. This was made possible through excellent work relationships in both the House and the Senate. A few examples of accomplishments for our district over the last 4 years are securing EVOS monies for the transfer of Termination Point in Long Island to the Kodiak Island Borough. I secured an additional $240,000 for the Department of Fish and Game budget directly and specifically for Kodiak Island. I secured an additional $20 million for the Alaska Marine Highway System, and I facilitated the first Tanner Crab fishery in Cordova in 32 years. Those are just a few examples of successes for District 32. Just as important, we need an independent voice who represents their constituents above any outside interests and works across the aisle to find solutions that benefit you. I have proven to be that independent voice. My office is very responsive to constituents, which is the most essential aspect of a representative government. I work for the people of District 32, and it's my job to go to bat for you, whether it simply is helping navigate the state bureaucracy or helping you with assistance in a larger endeavor. I have created excellent working relationships in the legislature. I've done a good job for our residents, and I've proven to be an effective representative in Juneau. I'd be honored to serve and represent you again for the next 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Rich, your opening statement.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Turn my mic on. All right. My name is Rich Walker. I've been a long time in the community of Kodiak for 28 years. I'm married to my wife, Julia Walker, Pruitt Walker, and we have 6 kids, and we have most of them all raised except for one last one at home. I have been very involved in the community over those years. I've been on the city council, where we've worked on many projects, infrastructure projects for the city of Kodiak. I've been there just finishing up my 6th year. And quite frankly, I'm tired of all the gridlock in Juneau. There's too much of that going on. We have too many serious problems that need to be faced so we can all move on and be back to the Alaska, the great land, the place that I originally moved to. And by doing that, you know, I believe in the sustainability of our fisheries, education for our children, and save the permanent fund dividend. So the other ones on my list are no new taxes. Rural Alaska can't afford any more taxes at all. I mean, they're all just barely getting by in the small communities, trying to keep their infrastructure projects up, and just trying to live their lives without, you know, without a lot of messing around with them from Juneau or local government. Economic development is number one on my list. We need to get out there and let everybody know that Alaska is ready for investment. We're ready to open up our natural resources. And, you know, we need to make a long-term fiscal plan that we can all agree on, that, you know, we can stick with. We're one of the richest states in the country with our natural resources, oil, gas, minerals, you know, renewable resources, fishing, and timber. We have to bring those, keep investing in those and moving forward. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there watching Alaska right now, and we got to step forward and let them know that, you know, we want to move forward with our investments and invest in Alaska. And then last but not least is our public safety.
Thanks, you know, Rich.
Thank you.
We'll go now to questions, beginning with Louise. Again, limit your response to 2 minutes. And some of these questions may be a bit involved, so if you would like me to repeat one, I'd be glad to do so. The first question, Louise. State limited entry permits and share catches in the federal IFQ programs can be prohibitively expensive. What can Alaska do, and specifically, what can you as a state representative do to make Alaska fisheries more accessible for new entrants?
Well, thank you for the question. That's a fairly easy question for me, being the chair of fisheries. There was a bill put forward by a representative out of Southeast Alaska, Representative Christ Tompkins, and it was for a permit bank. The bill had some issues with it, so I would venture to say that it wasn't the right vehicle, but it was certainly the right subject. And what it allowed was permits being held by local communities, whereas young fishermen could go and lease these permits and get a start. They would not be available for sale, but they could earn their income and get into the fisheries by leasing these permits from the local municipalities. As I said, there were some constitutional issues with it, but currently there's a bill by our own Senator Stevens. He's working with our local individual, Bruce Schockler, and that is for an apprenticeship. And that would allow young fishermen to have an apprenticeship on different boats and start out that way. They could fish the boat a portion of the year, and the other portion of the year, the owner and the skipper would be on the boat. But they would be allowed to learn to operate the boat and make deliveries. So I think that we're on the right track, and that's how I would begin. The other avenue is, of course, through funding, and we have just passed a bill this last year that which increased funding for the fisheries from $300,000 on the revolving loan fund, to $400,000, which allows for permit buying, partial boat buying, equipment buying. So I think that we're on that avenue.
Thanks, Louise. Rich?
Well, I'm going to make this real simple. IFQs were the worst thing we ever did to our state. And what we did to young people growing up in their communities and their families that need to get out there and believe in making livings and keeping the livings going that they've had for years and for centuries. You know what? A lot of my family are in fishing. And a lot of them have been blanked out of being able to join in on a lot of things because the permits are owned by so many people that have become rich and wealthy, and the rest of our towns are sitting around with kids out of work. So I would work forward to a better plan of some sort to be able to get our young people permitted and out there fishing with everybody else. It's got to change. There's some our economies, you know, need these young people to stay in the fisheries, and there's more and more of them leaving because they can't get into the fisheries. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Dennis, what would you do about the limited entry situation making fishery entrance expensive?
I think there's two really big issues here. I think one is that we a lot of times have politicians who make decisions on huge swaths of the economy, huge swaths of the population, when it's not necessarily their expertise. And I think that then after they do something, they can pat themselves on the back and then not get to it for a while. And I think we really need to analyze what's going on, looking at other states, what they've done. And we also need to look at the fact that it's the transition and the movement of the IFQs that's a real problem. And so potentially having a way for the state to have a pool of a small percentage or so of the IFQs being able to be used for new people trying to enter into the industry, and it to be a temporary thing that they wouldn't necessarily give, and also kind of promote people selling, especially to their own people who are working on the boats, because we have a lot of people who are working on the boats for years who don't have actual ownership of the product that they're catching. And I think that if we can find a way to stimulate them to really transition, then I think that we can have more people involved. And I think we also need to look at the other industries, the other committees that have a stake in this, and we need to have everyone involved in that process. I think that any one person that comes in and is struggling with this idea doesn't just do something for the sake of doing something, but listen to other people who really are experts. There's PhDs in this field. There's fishermen with their whole life. And I think that if we can bring people to the table and more effectively communicate and make sure all voices are heard and not just be someone trying to push across their own personal policy, I think we'll come across with a solution that everyone can be happy with.
Thank you. The next question will go to you, Rich.
Okay.
And it is as follows. In a decision on August 8, 2018, the Alaska Supreme Court approved most of the ballot initiative called Stand for Salmon, aimed at strengthening the state's salmon habitat protection, meaning the initiative will be on the November 6 ballot. Mm-hmm. What is your position on the Alaska ballot measure number one? As a legislator, how will you balance other industries' interests while also protecting salmon natural resources?
All right, thanks, Bill. My position on this bill is that, here we go again, the environmentalists are out there trying to tell us what to do with our state. It's a bad bill. It will close down economic development in our state. We have plenty of resources through fish and game. As long as we keep funding them and taking care of our salmon stocks, and we invest in research, technology. We find other reasons why right now in these last few years in North Pacific, our fisheries are dwindling. We've really had some bad turnouts this year. While keeping all of our fisheries sustainable, we must continue to expand and developing our resources for our communities. continuing on future regulation of the fisheries is mandatory. We must have catch limits. We must keep advancement on new technologies, control bycatch, and protecting our fisheries for future generations, guys. I mean, this bill would kill it, and it's not good for anyone.
Thank you, Rich. Dennis, do you need to hear this question again? Okay.
So we just got done talking about how do we get people into the fishing industry? How do we preserve it for generations? And we look at things with Stamper Salmon. That's what they're trying to do. And we look at right now, we're having this issue with one mistake with a mine, one, for instance, pebble mine, one mistake with some development, and then now we hurt a habitat for generations. And then when we talk about that, who's the one footing the bill for the cleanup? It's the taxpayers. What Stanford Salmon is doing, it's putting it to where the onus is more on the industries that are profiting, well, potentially at the expense of the salmon habitat. And we're also looking at right now with the fisheries, it's not doing very well right now. It's not like we're looking at increasing development and potentially hurting a resource that is doing great. We're looking at sacrificing a renewable resource for a one-time extraction, and we need to make sure that also the people held accountable and the ones profiting off it are the same people. We can't just have the state foot the bill for these mistakes and these accidents and then have people like in my generation that now can't get in fishing because there was a small mishap they said couldn't happen.
Thank you, Dennis. Louise?
Thank you. I do not support the ballot initiative. I think this initiative was created simply to put mining out of business. I don't believe in trading one resource for another. I believe we all live in this state and we need to work together to maintain our resources. I've had conversations with all the resource individuals, whether it be mining, oil, fisheries, timber. We all have the same outlook. We need to have a sustainable, renewable salmon. That's absolutely clear amongst all of us. We all live in this state. We all have to make a living in this state. And I believe it's perfectly reasonable to believe that we can come together and have sustainable salmon. I know that based on my own bill, House Bill 199, which has been put to the side while waiting for this initiative to see if it goes on the ballot and what it happens. It started out pretty reclusive. It is not as it has been in dealing with the stakeholders. We have been able to come to a meeting of the minds, and there's things that the miners don't like, and there's things that the miners have said, well, okay, we can live with. So I just don't believe in putting one resource out of business to the benefit of the other. I believe we can all work together and create an environment that we can all live within.
Okay, thank you, Louise. The next question will go first to you, Dennis. Senate Bill 26, passed this year, uses a portion of the permanent fund to pay for government services. Governor Walker called this landmark legislation and said it would reduce the deficit by $1.7 billion to just under $700 million. Critics say the permanent fund should not be used to reduce the deficit, but the legislature should look for budget cuts instead. Should permanent fund earnings be used to balance the budget? If not, what are some other policy ideas that would help keep the deficit under control?
I absolutely do not support cutting the PFD, and I do not think that cutting it helps preserve it, especially when that money is being used. It's not being set aside. And I think that when we talk about the budget issue, it's the fact that we couldn't come up with a budget, we had a deficit, and when we tried to balance it, we balanced it on the backs of hardworking people. When you see a single mom with three kids, when you see a family that needs the PFD for heat in the winter, when you cut it, you're saying they're bearing the burden. when people, if you're making $300,000 a year and you get a PFD cut, your life is virtually unaffected. When we look at people who are working every day, sometimes working multiple jobs, who don't have a voice in the legislature, who can't go to Juneau and talk to their representatives, those are the people who, when that PFD is cut, needs to make a decision between sometimes rent and food or heat in the winter. And I'm not okay with that. And if we're looking at sometimes taking 15, 20% of the income of some of the lowest earners in our society, then how are we okay with that, but not okay with finding a more fair, equitable way to deal with the budget? And I think we need to be efficient. We need to audit these services, because we can't just say, because it's government spending, it's in the general fund, that we need to support it. I think we need to audit and have it more itemized, and so we can actually look at where money is going, and then we can cut effectively. And then also, we're the only state in the nation that doesn't have a sales tax or income tax, and there's a lot of people that come in from other states. There's a lot of money that's gone or not being able to be used in Alaska, even though Alaska is the one providing these resources and services. So I think we need to find a more fair way to do it instead of balancing it on the backs of people who don't have a voice and who are struggling already.
Thank you, Dennis. Louise.
Thank you. And the last part of the question was on...
The last part of the question, or the second question, was... If not, if you don't want to use the permanent fund earnings to balance the budget, what are some other policy ideas that would keep the deficit under control? Dennis is talking about an income or a sales tax.
Okay, thank you for that. Thank you for clarifying that. On Senate Bill 26 and its passage, what that did is that put a spending cap on what the legislature can spend. So that's a start. We can only spend so much and take so much out of the earned reserves account or the constitutional budget reserve. That's important. The other thing that we need to remember is currently the state of Alaska is getting less for their oil than they have gotten in their history of having oil. We need to have a fair and reasonable oil tax figure. The average owner of the resource of oil gets a 70% take. The state of Alaska currently is getting a 20% take. So we could make a big difference by adjusting just our oil tax income. Dennis is right. The state of Alaska is the only state in the union that has no state taxes, no sales tax, no property tax, no income tax. So, but what people are forgetting is when we take, or when part of the permanent fund is taken and applied to the state expenses, the people of this state are receiving the benefit of those dollars. Those dollars are paying for public safety. They are paying for our Alaska Marine Highway System. They are paying for our part of our education. So ultimately, you are getting the benefit of those dollars. I believe in a continual and perpetual permanent fund dividend, which is what Senate Bill 26 has allowed.
Thank you, Louise. Rich?
Well, one of the big things right off the bat is we need to have those spending limits to help preserve the PFD and stop the government growth. The government's got to understand, you know, just like any of us in our homes, if you're not making the money, you can't spend a lot of money on luxury items. Like, we've got under that roller coaster for years, and we have to start watching how we spend our money. And we also have to start promoting the same time a better tax deal with our oil companies. You know, I read an article the other day, which I thought was great. Norway made a deal with their oil companies on a 50-50 split on all their resources in their oil. And they have a huge permanent fund themselves, and they're really doing well. The deals of up and down contracts and measures with the oil companies, kind of goes up and down like the price of oil. And, you know, the oil companies and us need to work together to reach an agreement to keep oil pumping down the pipeline. This is getting to be ridiculous. I don't know, most of us are older. how many boom and bust economies have we been through? It's ridiculous. But I will not cut the permanent fund on anyone. The reserve account is up to $18.7 billion right now. You know, if it's available, and it's only there by the vote of the House, if I remember right, just a certain percentage to be able to touch that. So, you know, we have all kinds of ways to move forward with our economies and build them up and get the state going again. We don't have to take a permanent fund check away from our public to be able to run our government. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. The next question will go first to Louise. Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Mallott have been outspoken concerning climate change and the need to mitigate its impact around the state. What legislative action, if any, do you think needs to be taken concerning climate change?
Well, in relation to that, I think that there are so many parameters that fall into this that are affected. Research is where we would start. I mean, we can see by our Arctic Ocean starting to melt. There, clearly, we need to look at our fossil fuel situation, the emissions that go into the environment. All of these things play a part, and I think it's clearly having an effect on Alaska, on Alaskan waters, on Alaskan lifestyle, on Alaskan weather. And so in order to mitigate it, I don't know. I think we start with research. That's the best I can say.
Thank you, Louise. Rich?
Yes, we have to keep investing in our science and our technology to make sure that the effect of everything we do in our state and our world is not causing worse situations. Some say right now, just because of the warming of the oceans and acidicity of the oceans, that's what's going on with our salmon. And, you know, we have to invest in that, and we can't just laugh it off and say it is not a problem. It is a problem. And it's something that we, you know, up in the Arctic, they have the research centers there. And, you know, the federal government is researching, you know, their side of it. But we have to keep up with the research and make sure that we're not all being affected by this. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Dennis, what do we do about climate change?
So for one, we're definitely being affected by it, especially these coastal communities with the heat waves, with the record-breaking temperatures. It needs to be a priority now. And also looking at it, we're ranked the worst state in the nation to do business in. And part of that is because our economy is really struggling. We have the highest unemployment, highest percentage of people working multiple jobs. What we need to do is invest in renewable energy because it's one of the fastest growing industries in all of America. What we can do is we can focus on that, create jobs. We can look at the model, even Kodiak, we're run almost entirely on renewable energy. Cordova has an amazing, super impressive microgrid system, and we can utilize that, we can expand it, we can then have a long-term plan, because oil is not a long-term plan. In 20 years, China is going to be coming off fossil fuels, India, other states are, and so if we don't have another source of revenue, if we don't have another industry that we're building now, we're going to be behind the curve in 20 years, probably sooner. And so if we look at investing in renewable energy, we'll create jobs, it's a growing industry, we would have another revenue source, and at the same time, it's also better for the future of Alaska, especially with the problems with the fisheries, the acidification. And I think that we need to make that a priority instead of kicking it down the road when we don't have any other options left and the budget has to be cut even more because oil goes back down to $26 a barrel.
Thank you, Dennis. The next question will go first to you, Rich. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game budget has been reduced over time due to Alaska's budget crisis. Many of the cuts have negatively affected the department's ability to do research. Presently, several of the state's key fisheries are in decline. That includes both pink and sockeye salmon in the Gulf and the Gulf Pacific cod fishery. What role can the state play in state and federal research to better understand these decisions, which most scientists think are attributed to the warming waters and or the blob?
Okay, well, you know, fisheries are, in our District 32, are the economic engine for our district. You know, and we really have to push hard in the legislature to make sure that funding, and we keep funding fish and game, fish and wildlife, and all of the research needs to keep going. I mean, we just can't just, you know, get by and just think everything is going to keep going the way it has for centuries. It's not going to work that way. There's too many influences to our climate, to our economies, and everything else. But we have to come up with ways to make sure that we keep funding the fisheries, research, development, and also new regulations for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Dennis, do you want the question again? The Alaska Department of Fish and Game budget has been reduced over time due to Alaska's budget cuts. Many of the cuts have negatively affected the department's ability to do research. Presently, several of the state's key fisheries are in decline, and that includes both pink and sockeye salmon fisheries in the Gulf and the Gulf Pacific cod fishery. What role can the state play in state and federal research to better understand these declines, which most scientists are attributing to warming waters and or the blob?
So I think when you look at that question, you also have to look at two separate things. One is, we're talking about cutting funding and then asking them to solve a question that hasn't been answered yet. And so one of the problems with not having another source of revenue is money goes down. We have a volatile economy. We can't necessarily invest in research. And also we can't invest in jobs. And so if you cut government spending, you then have a worse economy because it goes down. We're already in a recession. And I think that when we're asking a department to do more with less, and then asking them to solve problems that already are very difficult to answer, I think we're setting up for an almost impossible task. And so we need to get back to funding the government. And if we can do that, not only will we improve our fisheries, our research behind it, we'll be able to act on it sooner, and also we'll be able to create jobs so people who are struggling, people who have something that's their life work that they've committed to, won't be out on the street because, you know, we are kicking a can down a road.
Thank you, Dennis. Louise, what can we do to
Thank
better
you.
Understand the declines which most scientists are attributing to global warming?
I got it. Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to agree with everyone else. Clearly, our Department of Fish and Game has to be appropriately funded. It has been cut, and it has been cut, and it has been cut. And the more it's cut, the more conservative they manage their fisheries, which means the fewer fisheries that are prosecuted to its fullest extent. That's a problem. They absolutely have to be funded fully. They also, in my opinion, way underutilize some of their resources. And when I say underutilize their resources, I'm talking about the fishermen themselves. The fishermen are a huge resource and advantage to the Department of Game, Fish and Game, that are not being used for the information that they can be contributing to these different issues. So I would like to see a much closer working relationship between the fishermen themselves and the department.
Thank you, Louise. Question number 6 will go first to Dennis. Senate Bill 91, signed into law in July of 2016, limited jail time as a punishment for nonviolent and first-time offenders. Critics say the bill led to increased crime rates. In 2017, the legislature amended some portions of the law, including bringing back short-term prison sentences for theft convictions under $250. This year, House Bill 312 gave more power to judges to set bail amounts in low-level crime cases. The questions are, Did Senate Bill 91 lead to an increase in crime? And should the legislature impose stricter penalties for first-time and nonviolent offenders, including more jail time?
So this question partially goes back to my original point at the beginning of the day. When we make a decision, we need to analyze it. We need evidence. We need diverse voices involved from different backgrounds. We should have people on the ground talking about it. We should have people in policy talking, people in health. And we also have to look at the social aspect as well, because our unemployment is incredibly high. Our people working multiple jobs is one of the highest percentages in the nation. We have people who are struggling, who can barely keep food on the table, who can barely make ends meet. And we're creating a system where people are not set up to succeed. People are getting hurt. And I think that part of it is, if we can address the actual needs of the community, we can bring down crime that way and not just criminalize it. But also, when we talk about the specifics of SB 91, we also need to talk about bringing those other pieces in and making sure those are analyzed as well and effectively targeting each individual issue we have. When we look at some of the legislation, some of it is a little bit broad and painted with broad strokes. And I think criminal justice reform is very important, but I think if we can go down more to the issues themselves and the actual charges and be more specific with it, I think that we can more effectively reach our goal, which is both criminal justice reform, and also there was just the idea that a lot of people are being put in jail unnecessarily, and people are being hurt by the system with an unnecessary cost, which is then making it even harder for the government to do its job. So basically, we need to focus on why people are in the situation they're in, as well as analyze decisions after they're being made. And I think that we just need to really sit down and hammer this out.
Thank you, Dennis. Louise, SB 91, did it cause an increase in crime, and should there be stricter penalties?
SB 91 was an interesting document. It was an omnibus bill, and it was, when it originally came to the floor, it was agreed on by every agency that is involved in the criminal justice system, whether it be the courts, the public safety, the state troopers, local police departments. Everybody agreed on it. But certainly it had some long-reaching effects that were unforeseen, which were addressed, as you mentioned. You said House Bill 312, which is the same as Senate Bill 54. And I believe initially part of the problem with 91 was, as you mentioned, we took some of the authority away from the judges. We said to the judges, hey, look, if they don't have a criminal history, if this is their first time in, you got to let them go. We were telling the judges what to do. We also said to them, hey, if they have a criminal history in Washington, but they don't have one in Alaska, it doesn't count. We went back and we said, well, after these same agencies came back to the legislature and said, boy, we got some problems with this bill and here are the problems, we addressed it. We gave the authority back to the court system. We allowed the court system to have a look back on other states. We gave the discretion back to the judges as to what kind of penalties would be assessed, whether there would be jail time immediately or whether they would be let out. So I think we did a good job in giving the authority back to the court system. We also told them, if you find more issues with this bill, come back to us. We're going to work with you because we want to be safe just like you want the people of the state to be safe.
Thank you, Louise. Rich?
Yes and yes. Real simple. It caused more crime, and the sentences were ridiculous. You know, you have to, yeah, I know how this all started was like
five years ago.
Some people say I don't need a mic. But 5 years ago or so, everybody was arguing about the cost of prisons and law enforcement. And that's why this bill came around. But it's one of the worst pieces of legislation I've ever seen. It needs to be scrapped. We need to go back to the drawing board. We need to have stronger courts involved and stronger sentences for criminals. We can't just keep giving them get out of jail card free cards to get out just because it was a first offense. You know what? Once you get those doggone laws changed and the sentences are opened up for the judges to make real sentences, it deters crime. And the law enforcement community and the judges have been hamstringed long enough, and we need to get it taken care of.
Thank you, Rich. The next question goes first to Louise. Louise, the state gave a one-time increase in funding to education of $25 million, but no foundation increase in fiscal 19, and will give another increase in FY 20, this time for $30 million. However, unless increased funding is in the foundation formula, school districts can't depend on the additional money in the following year. Do you support early funding for education and a permanent increase in the foundation formula?
Yes, I do. The appropriation in 2019 was $20 million, not 25, but anyway. and you're correct, in 2020, it's $30 million. So in 2019, that equates to about an $85 BSA increase, and in 2020, it equates to about a $120 BSA increase. I am not a proponent of one-time funding because it does a lot of things. It puts the school districts in a position where they will be coming dependent on it. It does not allow them to have the ability to look into the future, see what kind of revenue they're going to have in order to set out their budget. It's things like that, one-time funding, that create down the road the pink slip situation. We don't want the pink slip situation, and the only way to alleviate that is to be able to put forward to this educational system a solid formula so they know what kind of revenue they can expect, and then they can set their budget accordingly. So, no, I am not a proponent of one-time funding, and yes, I am a proponent of long-term funding for education on a permanent basis, which would be through a BSA as opposed to one-time funding situations.
Thank you, Louise. Rich?
Thank you, Bill. We need to forward fund education. This ridiculous method that's been going on for years, they cannot even look forward to keeping teachers in their districts. You know, the pink slip system is correct. These school districts, there's no way. I mean, just look at our own district. We lost a whole bunch of teachers this year, you know, just because of that system. You know, so we have to come up with innovative ways you know, to support our education systems, new technologies, both for teachers and for students. And, you know, I'm a big proponent for our school districts. And, you know, I would even go as far as, you know, we, instead of fighting about that every year, we set up a fund, an actually state fund through the legislature and the state for education. And we take a little money out of the permanent fund earnings reserve and just have a yearly education fund that's set up for them in certain amounts so they know what they're getting. We fight about this. It seems like they fight. That's one of the biggest hard-fought fights every year in Juneau is education. And we need to cover down on our kids. They're our future. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Dennis?
So I'm incredibly passionate about education. I studied it in graduate school, and there's a lot of really exciting things on the horizon. But that does not negate the fact that teachers here cannot afford to stay here. We're not funding education adequately. We cannot keep teachers here. And that is because it is not enough of a priority of the legislature. We need to make sure we fully fund education. We fund teachers so they don't just stay 3 years and then leave. I think that we need to look at also addressing the fact that when we talk about what we're going to do going forward. We talk about it on a one-year basis. We spend 8 months between all the organizations involved developing a budget and then turn around a few months later and have to do it all over again. We need to do two-year budgets, and we need to stop just having this last-minute decision-making for all the legislature. And I think that if we can go to two-year, we can also be more conservative. More money comes in, we won't just spend it on pet projects. We can spend it on diversifying the economy, on bringing in new sources of revenue. And I think that if we can prioritize actually looking at the long plan with these different decisions, then we won't be scrambling every single year for a majority of the year, and then at the end of the day realize our kids' education is suffering. Our teachers aren't able to stay on the island. Our people are unable to just have basic needs to get fired and then rehired a month later because the budget was done after the school already set up its faculty list. And I think that when we look at the everyday cost of this, we're looking at people losing their jobs, getting them back, kids suffering, and we need to look more long-term, and we need to really prioritize this.
Thank you, Dennis. The next question goes first to Rich. Rich, the cost of health care continues to rise for residents, employers, and the state in terms of Medicaid, pensions, and as an employer. What can you, as a state legislature, do to help get the health care cost under control?
Well, the biggest part of that right there is what you said, is we have to take care of Medicare and Medicaid and how it's managed. It is ridiculous. It's costing our state billions of dollars. And that's all.
Thank you, Rich. Dennis, what would you do to control health care cost?
Only 2 minutes? No. So, first, we need to increase transparency. Because when we look at insurance companies and how much they charge, we don't really know. And it can be different from one hospital to the next. It can be different from one provider to the next. And we need transparency, because not only does that breed honesty, it breeds accountability. And I think that if we can actually look at what we're spending on, then that's the first step. We also need to look at focusing on primary care, because people end up in the ER because they had diabetes for 5-10 years, and now they're getting an amputation. Now it's the leading cause of blindness in adults. We look at these issues where people aren't able to go in a cost-effective way because they don't have access to care. We also look at the fact that Medicaid is one of the most efficient systems in the nation. It has like a 3% overhead cost, whereas a lot of these private insurers are 18%. So when we talk about Medicaid or Medicare being an inefficient system, that's just untrue. And I think that what we need to do is not only breed transparency, but we need to prioritize the health of our constituents. When we cut $20 million from healthcare, but then can give stocks and subsidies to the most profitable companies in the world, like the oil companies, then that, to me, says that we're not fighting for our constituents as hard as we should be, and we're not prioritizing them above everything else. And I think that's where, if we can get the money out of politics, get the power to the people, then we can get real change, and people won't have to make these life and death decisions because healthcare is so expensive. We shouldn't have people going bankrupt because of healthcare. And we can talk about the cost, we can talk about the efficiency, but we also, at the end of the day, need to realize that people are dying because they don't have care.
Thank you, Dennis. Louise, how would you control healthcare cost?
Well, I would start with widening the field. And I know that the state of Alaska is very difficult. When a licensed physician applies for their license in the state of Alaska, it can take anywhere from 6 to 18 months to get that license. Whereas if you go down to Washington, Oregon, Idaho, you can have that license within 30 or 60 days. We're losing physicians because they simply can't get licensed in the state of Alaska. That would help immensely. I think that if we had some sort of policy or availability, our state employees have insurance, as do our school employees have the ability to have insurance. Why couldn't we get some kind of blanket insurance policy that allows the people of the state to also participate in the same type of insurance plan that these people are, that our state employees are employed in as a payer? That would certainly decrease costs. I think that our Medicaid and Medicaid system does need some revamping. I certainly think it's a worthwhile system, and there are definitely individuals that it has been, that it's crucial for. But I also believe that it's an abused system. To me, there's a red flag when you have a young person who is working part-time and has an offer of a full-time job but refuses to take it because they're going to lose their Medicaid. That's a red flag. There's something wrong with our system when we have young people who are totally capable of working and don't want to do it because they're going to lose their medical insurance that's being provided for them. So if we had some kind of plan that we as citizens of Alaska could draw from, I think that would help as well.
Thank you, Louise. The next question will go first to Dennis. Dennis, the state of Alaska has requested federal disaster declarations and relief funds from the federal government for 7 poor pink salmon fisheries in 2016 and for the 80% decline in the Gulf of Alaska Pacific cod quotas for 2018. There's now speculation there'll be another disaster request for some sockeye fisheries across the state this year. Do you think federal disaster declarations and relief funds requested by the state for fishery relief is appropriate?
So I do. Partly also because our state does not have is not diversified its economy well enough. And I think that if we have fisheries doing poorly, we have mom-pop shops doing poorly. We have the local community doing poorly. We have people who are out of work. And I think that that trickles down to a lot of the community. And so when we talk about putting money back into looking at the disaster relief funding, we're also looking at people who are dependent on it because their family is. And I think that when we talk about what we're going to do with the funding, we need to look at all the people involved. And I think that's also where, when we talk about the unemployment rate and the issues of people working multiple jobs, people not being able to afford housing, I think that that's where if we can improve that, then these times of year, these years where we don't do very well in the fishing industry, then people aren't as negatively impacted in the entirety of Alaska. And I don't remember what the exact statistic is, but the majority of people in Kodiak, when the fisheries get hurt, they get hurt, whether they're in it or not. And I think that if we only look at it as a fisheries issue, that's just short-sighted. And so a lot of our community is hurting, and we need a lot of help because we're also already in a bad spot as a state where our economy is doing so poorly. We're in a recession. People are already struggling.
Thank you, Dennis. Louise, do you think the federal disaster declarations that you requested are appropriate?
You're correct. I did request it. And it was in response to a concern from my constituents. I think that it was appropriate at the time. I still think it's appropriate. I think we're on a slippery slope. I think that when you're a fisherman, you know you have some up seasons and you have some down seasons. I think with the complexion of the financial state of the state of Alaska, as well as the federal government, I think for us to depend on it because we have a poor season is going to be a slimmer and slimmer proposition. It would be nice to think that would be the case, but I just don't believe that's going to be the case. And I think once again, it goes back to, you know, that's part of the nature of the beast. You know, I was married to a fisherman for 42 years. He fished for 42 years, and we've been married for 25, so I know the ups and downs of fisheries.
Thank you, Louise. Rich?
Yes, with the state of our economy right now, we definitely need help with our fishermen. I was over in Cordova just a couple weeks ago, and it was just dead. They were waiting for their first opening. Boats sitting in the harbor. Same thing, the Chicxulub fishery has been really bad and some other areas around the state. And, you know, we have to help these people out and get them back on their feet. Sometimes it takes years to get that funding. We're just now are getting some allocated from 2016. But definitely, we need to keep trying for those funds from the federal government to help out our economies.
Thank you, Rich. Time is running short, so we're going to go to closing statements, and we'll begin with Rich Walker. Rich?
Well, thank you. I got in this race because I was tired of seeing the last 2 years the gridlock and the waste of time and money down in Juneau. We've had too many things going on down there that I just was not happy with. I am willing to pull up my sleeves, go down there, and give my best shot at making things better. And that is, you know, working across the aisles, you know, with my years in management and working with people. I have a good background in on those things. I will protect the permanent fund for the people of Alaska. I will not vote for an income tax. And I'll guarantee we get a better crime bill than the one that we just have lived through for the last few years. I love the people of Kodiak in District 32. There's a lot of good people out there struggling, and I want to do the best I can down there to help out and, you know, to make Alaska a great place to live again. We have to get our economy up and rolling again, you know, with all of our natural resources, you know, between oil, gas, mining, timber, our fisheries. We have to get that engine going, and we need to get Alaska to bounce back. And then we need to work together to make sure that our economy does not go through the boom-bust cycles that it has over the last 30 years, 34, almost 40 years since I've been here. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Dennis, your closing statement.
I got into this race because I felt like hardworking Alaskans needed a voice in politics. We look at things like the PFD being cut and then people having to go without food or having to choose between heat and paying rent. We look at unemployment being the worst in the nation and that not being on the table every single day. Looking at the fact that people are going bankrupt because they can't afford their health care. Looking at the fact that, yes, there's a lot of things going on, but rent is due on the first. People are leaving the island because they can't afford to live here. In all of Alaska, we're struggling with this. And when they try and fix these problems, when they try and balance the budget, it's not a fair way that everyone feels equally. It's put on the backs of the people who are already struggling most. We look at people who are stuck, who don't have hope anymore because they don't have someone who is fighting for them, who's going to be there every single day saying, we just need a chance. And so I'm running because I want to be that person. I want to be the person who someone can always go to no matter what's going on. If they feel like they don't have a voice, they don't know who to turn to, if they just feel down and out, when they just get super fed up about politics, I've been there. They still know there's someone in there fighting. And so.
Thank you, Dennis. Louise, you got the last word.
Oh, thank you. You know, I would like to say that I'm confident in the representation that I've put forward for District 32. I've done this with honesty and with integrity and will continue to do so. You have undoubtedly already received flyers in the mail saying otherwise. And my response to that is twofold. First, political flyers and ads are not required to be factual, believe it or not. Secondly, keep in mind, dollars funding these flyers and ads are not from Kodiak, but are from the state Republican Party, as well as the Republican Party out of Washington, D.C. They're very unhappy that I have chosen to listen to my constituents and their concerns over the party's demands. I'm more than happy to discuss any of my votes or actions taken on behalf of this district at any time and encourage any one of you to contact me with any questions or concerns that you might have. I really appreciate the opportunity I've been afforded tonight in presenting myself to you all this evening, as well as the opportunity to set the record straight as to exactly who I am and what I stand for, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. And that brings our forum to a close. I want to thank KMXT Public Radio for broadcasting this effort. I want to acknowledge the chamber personnel and the volunteers whose efforts have made this happen. I want to thank all three candidates, not only for appearing on this forum, but for being willing to serve the rest of us in this important and often thankless position. Finally, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your attention and your interest. Consider what you've heard, make up your mind, and vote on August 21st. Good night, and I'll see you at the polls.